Hi, podcasters. Ira Flatow here with a request. You know from listening to the show that we deal in facts and realities. And one of those realities is that it takes many hundreds of thousands of dollars to make Science Friday and these free podcasts that hopefully you enjoy. The other reality is that we at Science Friday have to raise a great majority of that money ourselves. Yes, we get some from your donations to your public radio station, so please keep doing that. But that only covers a fraction of our costs. And sure, we get some money from the underwriting announcements here, but hardly enough to cover our expenses. Hundreds of thousands of you download these podcasts each week, each month. You have the power to keep us going. If every one of you gave us just a dollar, we could ensure the future of these broadcasts and these podcasts. We need your help. Please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the donate button there. Give us $1, $5, whatever you think it's worth to you to keep Science Friday part of your week. Please donate what you can at sciencefriday.com. And thanks. And now, on to the program. Deep below the Pacific, a drill is boring into the Earth's rocky crust, aiming for the mantle. The goal is not to find oil, but treasure. This hour, we'll talk about what scientists are looking for and why a similar project, started 50 years ago, failed. Will they have better luck this time? Then new analysis of an experiment done 50 years ago suggests the building blocks of life formed not in that famous primordial soup, but when bolts of lightning shot through the sulfurous gases of volcanoes. Finally, a discovery of prehistoric stone blades from Texas sets back humans' arrival in the Americas by 2,500 years, predating the Clovis period. Time to rewrite the history books? Some answers in your questions. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Sometimes we forget that scientists are human, and they might avoid unpleasant experiments. Presented for your consideration, one Stanley Miller. Back in the 1950s, Stanley Miller and his mentor, Harold Urey, performed a very famous experiment on the origins of life on Earth. They filled flasks with the gases believed to have been present on the early Earth, things like ammonia and methane and hydrogen. They then shot sparks through the gases to mimic lightning bolts. And lo and behold, they found that their experiment had indeed produced a variety of amino acids, the building blocks of life. Stanley Miller died a few years ago and left a lot of those experimental samples on the shelf in boxes full of tiny sealed glass vials, carefully labeled. Some of them were from experiments he never analyzed, including one experiment that mimicked the conditions of an erupting volcano. Why did he not open those vials? Perhaps Miller didn't like the way they smelled. Perhaps they smelled like sulfurous, rotten eggs. Now, over 50 years later, some of his former students have gone through those volcanic samples, analyzing even the smelly, sulfurous ones. And they've made a startling discovery that Miller missed, but might change our view about the chemical evolution of life on Earth. And they've published the results in this week's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Joining me to talk about what they found is my guest, Jeffrey Beta, Distinguished Professor of Marine Chemistry at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thanks. Glad to be with you.
Can you give us your insight why Stanley Miller never opened those vials?
Well, I wish I could tell you definitely, but my suspicion is for two reasons. Number one, he had told several of us that he hated working with H2S, hydrogen sulfide, because it just smelled so bad. It made him sick. And so that may be one reason. The other reason is that he did this experiment when he was at Columbia University, only for a couple of years, and he was obviously very busy at that point, traveling to Europe and getting ready to move, in fact, out here to UC San Diego. So it may have been a combination of that. But anyway, he prepared these samples in his meticulous way, labeled them, including the notebook page where we could find all the details of the experiment, and then just put them in this little box and stowed them away.
And so what made you decide to open them?
Well, I'd found out by chance in 2007 that Stanley had saved extracts from all his original experiments. I'd known Stanley since 1965, and I was a very close friend of his. He never told me anything about saving extracts from his original experiments, and it was only by chance that another colleague happened to mention that when he was in Stanley's office, Stanley pointed to this cardboard box and said, "That's contains samples from my original experiments." And when I found this out, I realized, since I'd inherited everything in Stanley's lab and office, that I must have the box. And so I looked through my lab, and sure enough, here was this dusty cardboard box labeled discharge samples. And I opened it up, and inside were all these other little boxes clearly labeled with each of his early experiments. And the first thing we did was analyze this one set of boxes that was associated with an experiment that he carried out in his thesis work in the 53. That involved a different kind of apparatus, one that had a configuration that, in our opinion, looked more like a volcanic-type discharge than the spark discharge sample system that he'd used, that we sort of call a classic apparatus that you see in textbooks. And we analyzed that and found that it contained a wide diversity of amino acids that had never been reported before in these kinds of experiments. And we published that in Science in 2008. My attention then turned to this experiment labeled 1958 because it clearly said that one of the gases in the mixture was hydrogen sulfide. And he'd never conducted an experiment before with hydrogen sulfide. And very few experiments had actually been conducted with hydrogen sulfide. So I thought, okay, this is the next logical set to analyze, and it was a real eye-opener when we found that it contained probably the most diverse set of amino acids ever produced in this kind of experiment.
And so the theory being that this was mimicking volcanic outgassing on the planet at the time.
Right. We know that hydrogen sulfide, along with other gases like methane, ammonia, were probably being belched into the atmosphere continuously by early volcanic systems. You have to remember that the Earth at this time probably had no continents, and the only thing that would have been covering the surface of the Earth, that covered the oceans actually, were little volcanic island arc type systems like the Hawaiian Islands. And so these things would have been belching out reduced gases, and also, as we saw in great detail last year with the Icelandic volcano, volcanic eruptions are accompanied by really intense lightning. So the idea is these gases are belched out of the volcano and immediately subjected to a discharge. And so you'd have synthesis not on a global scale, but on these local scales. So you'd have these millions of these little tiny localized prebiotic factories operating on the surface of the early Earth.
Mm-hmm. And so this is something Stanley could have discovered if he had analyzed the samples himself.
Well, I don't think so, because the analytical heat techniques he had available at the time, paper chromatography, was very limited in what could be detected. And in all these early experiments, the largest number of amino acids that he could clearly detect was on the order of 5 or so. Mm-hmm. And so that shows you the limitation of the technique he had at the time. In comparison, today we have these powerful high-performance liquid chromatography mass spectrometry techniques that allow us to detect hundreds mm-hmm. of compounds in a mixture and determine that they're present based on their mass spectra. And so when we did this, we could clearly see a lot of compounds that he would have just never probably thought of trying to find, because number one, they weren't present in very much large amounts, and second of all, he may not even have the standards, the knowns, mm-hmm. to compare it with.
So does that make us rethink this whole primordial soup idea, that it was not so much as the soup on the ground, but the chemicals in the volcanoes might have been?
Well, you remember that the scenario about how amino acids are synthesized, when you send a spark, like the spark discharge, through a mixture of gases like methane, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, what you do is manufacture in that process what we call precursor reagents, hydrogen cyanide, aldehydes and ketones, things like formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, and sulfur derivatives. And these then rain out of the, quote, atmosphere and end up in solution in the water phase, where they undergo the actual synthesis reactions that make amino acids. So the amino acids are made in the liquid phase. The reagents are made in the gas phase. So the great thing about a volcano is that you have these reduced gases coming out of the volcano, and they're processed immediately into reagents, and these then rain out in the vicinity of the volcano, perhaps in tide pools or other bodies of water surrounding the volcano, and there they undergo this further chemistry to produce amino acids and other compounds. I think I should emphasize that amino acids are just an indicator that you've got synthesis taking place. There are many, many other types of compounds that are synthesized in this process.
Mm-hmm. So what is the take-home message here, Dr. Beta, in the minute we got left? What is the new thing that we should learn from this?
Well, I think it demonstrates that it's really easy to make key biomolecules like amino acids. And this then provides an inventory of raw material to set the stage for further reactions that lead to more complexity and eventually into something that we could call a living entity.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that we find some of these same types of chemicals on meteorites, that's important too?
Well, I think it shows you that this chemistry is universal. One of the interesting things that we point out in the paper is the relative abundances of the amino acids that we find in this hydrogen sulfide experiment is almost a direct overlay with the relative abundances found in certain meteorites, mainly carbonaceous chondrites, like the famous Murchison meteorite. And so what this is telling us is that the kind of chemistry that's being duplicated in this experiment is being duplicated under natural conditions someplace in the early solar system.
And would that mean there might be either life occurring in those places also, or we're bringing those precursors here, or both?
Well, I think it shows, again, that the ability to the robustness of how organic compounds is made, wherever you have the proper conditions, you're going to make organic compounds. Whether you can actually transport and tack those organic compounds to the Earth in significant quantities or some other planet, we really don't know right now. My suspicion is that you had both infall from space with organic-rich meteorites such as Murchison, and also homegrown synthesis via processes that, like we've just been discussing.
Are any more vials left to open?
Oh, there's probably 300 vials. He saved everything. There's experiments in there that he uses other combinations of reagents. There's some ones that has metals in them. About probably two-thirds of the vials he never reported the analyses of. And we've looked in his archive material that's in our library here, and I see no evidence in some of these cases that he ever saved, if he did analysis, that he ever saved them, and he certainly didn't publish it.
So you've got some work to do.
So we have a lot of other interesting stuff to look at.
All right, and we'll have you back on. Please check in when you keep opening those vials.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Jeffrey Beta is a distinguished professor of marine chemistry at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, talking about Stanley Miller's vials. They've got hundreds of them. Two-thirds of them never opened. That'll be really interesting to see what's happening. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about something completely different. We're going to talk about journey deep below the Pacific through the seafloor crust, the Earth's crust, toward the mantle. But first, Clovis will be coming up, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this message. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When and how did humans first arrive in the Americas? For years, scientists have thought the first travelers arrived here at the end of the last ice age somewhere around 13,000 years ago. And they got here by wandering over a land bridge from Siberia to Alaska. And archaeologists have found distinctive spear points from the same time period at sites all over the Americas. They're called Clovis points, after the town of Clovis, New Mexico, where they were first discovered. But now a new discovery of stone chippings and blades has some scientists rethinking when the settlers first set foot in the Americas, because this new catch of stone tools from Texas predates the Clovis period by thousands of years, suggesting that people were here as long ago as 15,000 years ago. It's about 2,500 years earlier than we thought. How did those earlier people get here? Can we really be sure these newly discovered artifacts are from the same earlier time? How accurate is that dating? Joining me now to talk about the research is one of the authors of a study that's out in this week's journal Science. Michael B. Collins is director of the Galt Archaeological Project. He's also a research professor of anthropology at Texas State University and San Marcos. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Collins.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Ira. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. And I see you've been very busy.
I've been busy. I have indeed.
Well, tell us what kind of artifacts first that you found there. Lots of them.
Yes, quite a number of them, and the number is large because most of the pieces are small, but they are distinctive. They're clearly man-made. They are the chippings from making and refurbishing stone tools, and one stone tool can produce 300, 400 or more chips. So, not surprisingly, the Deborah Friedkin site has produced many more chips than it has finished tools.
Right.
And in fact, the finished tools are a few in number, and most of those are worn out and damaged. So they're not a full representation of what the stone tool industry of that time and place looked like.
If our listeners would like to join in on the conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255. And you all can leave us a message, or you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or join the discussion on our Facebook page /SciFry. How significant is this finding, and how sure are you of how old they are?
Well, let me turn your question around a little bit and say that we're very confident in this particular effort of dating an older than Clovis site. The nature treated us well. We do not have preserved material suitable for radiocarbon dating, so we're relying on an alternative technique that's less widely used called optically stimulated luminescence dating, and OSL for short. OSL dating depends on high-quality samples, and that's true in most sciences, isn't it? That the better the samples you start with, the better results you're going to have at the end. And the quality of the quartz grains that we use is excellent, so our dating is good. And our OSL dates are in nice, well-stratified geologic deposits. There is a stack of cultural materials from about 1,000 years old going, as you go deeper, they go back in time to 13,000. Those are all known, recognized cultures. Mm-hmm. Our OSL dates line up with the known ages of those cultures. So when we look at the dates 13,000 to 15,000 plus underlying Clovis, and we have artifacts down there, we have a good deal of confidence in that. And that is what makes this particular site of high importance.
How much luck is involved here?
A good deal of luck, but there's also a good deal of just plain hard research that goes into locating a site like this, knowing what to do with it when you get there, and then excavating, analyzing, studying, and reporting it.
And let's talk about that a bit, because you have to have some sort of luck in finding the right site, but I'm sure there's a lot of research that goes into it.
That's right.
But why do you go deeper and where some other scientists might have stopped?
Well, we are working against an inertia, two inertias really, that one has said for very many years that that Clovis was the oldest culture in the Americas at around 13,000 to 13,000, 200 or 300 years ago. And some people haven't gotten over that, in spite of the fact for the last nearly 20 years we have had quite a few sites with strong indications of people being here before Clovis. And another thing, and that's improving. More and more people are accepting the concept, or at least willing to investigate it. The other thing, the other inertia that we have, and it's also improving rapidly and greatly, American archaeology has grew up in the social sciences. And not long ago, the vast majority of practicing archaeologists in this country had very little background in the earth sciences, and consequently didn't really think about the fact that, okay, I have found cultural material here, I'm back in this excavation to Clovis, so that's the oldest culture, I'll just quit here, without thinking, you know, the dirt below that's just a little bit older, why don't I look at that and see what's in it? There just wasn't that, that mindset was not particularly common. Mm-hmm. But happily, both of those things are changing for the better.
Mm-hmm. There's a hypothesis that first Americans may have crossed over around 16,000 years ago, not from the familiar Siberian land bridge that we've heard about, but from Europe. How does that hypothesis come about, and is there any evidence to support it, and how do you cross the Atlantic Ocean?
Well, those are huge questions. And it's a bold hypothesis that has been around for a while, but it's currently being formulated and talked about, and not enjoying a whole lot of acceptance. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the earliest archaeological materials that we know from the western side of the Western Hemisphere, all down the west side of North America and South America, there is a technology, a way of making stone tools that really has an Asian flavor to it. And it probably fits with genetic and other evidence that much of the ancestry of the Americas derived out of Siberia, biologically and technologically. Mm-hmm. On the other side of the continent, some of the earliest archaeological evidence that we have actually has a, and this includes Clovis, has a technological signature very similar to the Solutrean culture of primarily France and Spain that dates between about 21,000 and 16,000 years ago. That technology is so similar that it's awfully hard to imagine it having sprung up independently in two different places. So then you have the question of how do you bring a culture across the North Atlantic? Well, A, we know that if anyone got to the Americas before about 13,500 years ago, they almost certainly had to come by boat, because the entire span of Canada from the Pacific to the Atlantic was under an ice sheet. So people had to have come around that. If they came down the Pacific coast, they're bound to have used boats along the near shore. We know that people in Japan were plying the waters of the Pacific by 33,000 years ago in boats. We know that people arrived on the Solomon Islands and Australia by 50 or so thousand years ago. That had to have involved watercraft of some kind. So boat technology has a great time depth in human technological history. The nature of the waters of the North Atlantic and the North Pacific is such that they support one of the most enormous biotas in the world. The numbers of fish, sea mammals, seabirds, and even land mammals, if you want to include the polar bear, those food masses make the Serengeti Plain look like a desert.
Yet you say this theory is not very well accepted.
That's true, but and it's because nobody has very thoroughly and systematically put together all the various lines of evidence. Mm-hmm. That's about to change later this year. Dennis Stanford of the Smithsonian Institution and Bruce Bradley of Exeter University in England have a book that's in the final stages of editing at University of California Press, putting together the oceanographic, archaeological, ethnographic evidence that really tightens up that hypothesis. And they simply present it as a hypothesis. But I find it a very compelling one.
1-800-989-8255. It is a really interesting theory. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in. Chris in Michigan. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my questions have already been addressed, but it was that first I want to commend you for publishing this information. It's extremely courageous considering the environment you're doing it in. My question was why Clovis points have never been found in Siberia, but yet Solutrean, which you already addressed, points in the Iberian Peninsula and Southern Europe are virtually indistinguishable. My second question would be, have you read First American by Chris Hardiker? And I will get off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm aware of Chris Hardiker's work, but I haven't read it. So I will sidestep that part of the question. I think the reason we don't find Clovis in Siberia is that it never was there, that this was a different tradition of tool making. It shows up in northeastern Asia and all the way down from Alaska to southern Chile and into the interior of the Americas quite some distance. I believe that is a movement of technology out of northeastern Asia and down the western side of the western hemisphere.
Okay,
I think it involved boats.
We're talking about Clovis this hour on Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Michael Collins. One tweet came in. Why is it the first artifacts were found in New Mexico? Seems like an unlikely area as opposed to coasts.
Well, by the time of Clovis, I think people had been here quite a number of thousand years. The Friedkin site certainly suggests that. The Monteverde site in Chile suggests that, 1 to 2,000 years older than Clovis. So by then, people had spread from the coastal margins all across the interior of the Americas. And the earliest discoveries of Clovis almost exclusively were at places where Clovis points were associated with skeletons of mammoths. And mammoths are very big animals, and they're very big bones. And people would spot these in gravel quarries or in erosional gullies and so forth and so on, and it would attract their attention, and they'd get poking around, and they would find artifacts associated with those bones.
Mm. The artifacts that you've uncovered that you say are thousands of years older than Clovis, when you look at them, are there any signs of them that might point to a coming of Clovis later?
That's a debatable question. Mm-hmm. I sort of lean toward the fact that most of the Friedkin artifacts don't suggest a continuity with Clovis, but Professor Waters and his research group at Texas A&M feel like there are more similarities and that they may have an antecedent to Clovis represented there. Well, this will be This will be a debate that will go on for some time, I'm sure.
And I'm sure the debate's going to get thicker as you talk about that theory of coming over from North America, from Europe to North America.
Absolutely. That'll add another dimension to it. I mean, that one's already controversial, and it's hardly, it's just barely been presented in print at this point.
And you, what are you going to be up to next?
Well, I'm working on a site just literally 300 meters from the Friedkin site. That's the Galt site. It is an enormous Clovis site, the largest and most prolific Clovis site in the Western Hemisphere. I've been working on it for 20 years. We're nearing the end of our field work and beginning to do the analysis, and before long we'll be producing a definitive monograph on that site.
Can you give us a hint, a little preview?
It too has stuff older than Clovis that we've found and not yet reported.
So it's got older stuff there also. Yeah. And we'll wait for you to come back and talk about it, because it looks like we, as you say, we are opening up the debate one more time.
Yes, we are, and it will continue. You know, Ira, this is the most exciting time to be in one of the most exciting research fields imaginable. It changes every day.
And you just hate your job, then?
I hate my job. Just like you hate yours. It shows, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Well, enjoy yourself. You have to enjoy yourself in your work, right?
Yes, you do.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you for taking time out of your busy work schedule to come and talk with us today.
I thoroughly enjoyed it, and the best to you, Ira.
Thank you. Well, we'll talk to you later. I'm waiting for that new monograph to come out, and we'll talk to you when it comes out.
Good.
Have a good weekend. Michael B. Collins is director of the Galt Archaeological Project. He's also a research professor of anthropology at Texas State University in San Marcos. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about drilling down deep toward the Earth's mantle. Just what is a mantle? It's not a sports figure in this case. We'll talk about it later after this break. Stay with us. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Remember way back in the days of playing in the sandbox when you tried to dig a hole to China? Yeah, you know, you thought if you dug long enough, eventually you'd come out the other side. Well, kids are curious about this stuff. They want to know what's down there. And as it turns out, scientists want to find out, too. Some kids just never grow up. They become scientists. And deep under the Pacific Ocean, 500 miles off the coast of Costa Rica, they're drilling deep down through the Earth's crust into hard crystalline rocks, layers upon layers of solidified magma. They're headed for the Earth's mantle. Ever wonder what the mantle is? We're going to talk about what the mantle is, why they're headed for that, and what they hope to learn there. They've still got a ways to go to reach it. They're only about a third of the way there. What do they want to find out? If oil rigs, for example, can drill 8, 9, 10 miles into the seafloor for wells, what's so challenging about drilling a core just a few miles deep? Well, we're going to find out. Damon Teagle is a professor at the University of Southampton, based at the National Oceanographic Center at Southampton in the UK. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Teagle.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. What is the mantle?
The mantle is the next layer down in our planet. We live on the crust, and then the crust encircles our whole planet. But the mantle is a layer that's about 3,000 kilometers thick. So, you know, 2,000-odd miles thick, principally made of magnesium silicate, and that's actually the largest proportion of our planet.
Is the mantle?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
And so you want to go down there to just sample it?
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't think we can actually go and visit it, so we're going to have to do this with a drill ship and to drill there. But yes, I mean, it is. All of the rocks from the crust at one stage were produced by partially melting the mantle. So actually it's the most important chemical reservoir of our planet. So if we really want to understand how our Earth has evolved over Earth's history since its formation, then we sort of need to have a very precise view of the chemical composition of the mantle.
Mm-hmm. Now, I remember from my childhood, I remember there was Project Mohol, that they tried to get down there, but they never did. Was that back in the 1960s?
Yes. Well, I mean, one reason for this article we've just published in Nature magazine, which is just a comment, is to mark the 50th anniversary of Project Mohol, which was beautifully illustrated by John Steinbeck, actually in Life magazine back in 1961.
The author?
Yes. Who was, I think, a near neighbor in Monterey Bay of Willard Bascom, who was sort of the chief engineer scientist involved with the project. And Steinbeck was actually aboard the ship, this drilling barge, Cuss 1, when they attempted to do the drilling. But back in 1961, you know, this is before plate tectonics was just sort of a nascent theory at that stage, certainly before it was widely accepted. And they didn't really have much idea about how the Earth worked or even understand sort of the layering within the oceans that people had observed from looking at seismic waves, so looking at earthquake waves and looking at seismic waves such as the oil companies do.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about drilling into the mantle. And in fact, we have a little mini recreation of Flora Lichtman put together, a little mini mohole on our website if you'd like to take a look at our video on our website at sciencefriday.com about how you drill into the mantle. Why is it so difficult? Why is it, as I said before, if oil companies can drill so many miles down, what's the big deal about drilling into the mantle?
Yeah, this is the big difference that we're, you know, for that scientists who are interested in the formation and evolution of the ocean crust and also about the nature of the MOHO, which is this boundary between the crust and the mantle itself, is that we're drilling into very hard crystalline rocks that form from the crystallization of magma. Whereas oil companies, when they're drilling into sedimentary rocks that have sort of been laid down in the oceans over the eons and capture organic material that eventually evolves to form petroleum and gas. So actually the rocks we're drilling into are the rocks that sit beneath the sedimentary reservoirs that host the oil and gas. So they can drill deeper holes, but they're not drilling into such hard rocks.
Mm-hmm. And so what does a core look like that you hope to bring up?
A core, well, when things are going well, we tend to sort of retrieve these effectively long sticks of rock that are about 3 inches across, we do what's called wireline drilling. So we'll advance the drill bit about about 30 feet or so, and then recover the core after 30 feet of advancement. So, you know, when it's going well, it all comes out in big long sticks. When it's not going so well, it comes out as little sort of crushed up bits of rock.
Mm-hmm. And so this is purely basic research then. There's really nothing practical that's going to come out of this.
Well, you never know what's going to be practical, do you? But the fundamental drivers of this are about understanding how the planet works, how plate tectonics work, and how our planet has evolved.
Mm-hmm. Why if we're on a plate and there is plate tectonics, why doesn't the drill shaft shift and shear off that little drill bit that you have on the end?
Because plate tectonics is operating reasonably slowly. Mm-hmm. We're talking centimeters a year of movement. And of course, that's one of the things we don't know, because our aim is to drill through, you know, the 6 kilometers of the ocean crust into a few hundred meters into the mantle. The mantle itself, of course, is solid, but we don't actually know the coupling between the mantle rocks and the crust, whether they move together or whether they've always moved together or one has moved faster than the other and dragged the other along. That's one thing we'd like to find out.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989 8255. Aladdin in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi. My question I've always wanted to know is why, when you, as you dig into the mantle, as you get deeper, it gets hotter. The temperature gets hotter. Yet when you go into the ocean, the deeper you get, the temperatures get colder.
All right. Good question.
So you're saying, why does it get hotter?
Why does it get hotter as you get in deeper into the mantle?
Well, it gets hotter as we go inside the Earth as well, doesn't it? I mean, this is... I mean, the oceans are relatively well mixed compared to the Earth on the sort of timescales. But, you know, certainly the crust gets hotter because there's more radioactive decay. And also there's a lot of heat coming from very, very deep in the Earth from the operation of the of the geodynamo, and also through mantle convection, hot rocks are brought up on very slowly from deep within the Earth to near the to the bottom of the crust.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Randy in Tallahassee. Hi, Randy.
Hi. My question is, how do you know that the mantle is uniform throughout the perimeter of the Earth? How do you know that when you get a core sample that you won't just be getting a snapshot of that particular area where you took the sample?
Yeah, good question.
Well, that's an excellent question. Yes, and of course, you're completely right. It is unlikely to be... I think what I was saying before is that this discontinuity, this seismic boundary called the MOHO, is all around the planet. And it could be that the MOHO is not the same everywhere. In terms of getting samples of the mantle, well, we sort of have to start somewhere. It is unlikely that the composition will be identical everywhere. And one of the things we would like to know is the sort of the scale of the variations of these chemical heterogeneities. Because we can, and we have, you know, scientists have dredged rocks from along the spreading ridges, particularly where the ocean plates are spreading apart very, very slowly, and they see that there are certainly chemical heterogeneities, you know, chemical variations, but they very rarely get those rocks in any context, so we don't actually know the scale of those sorts of variations. So that's definitely something we would like to find out.
Good question, Randy. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
If you've never been down there, how do you know what is down there?
Well, we have, you know, snippets of information. You know, we know a lot about the nature of the center of the Earth, principally from seismic experiments, from the fact that the Earth has a magnetic field. Also, we do get some small chunks of mantle rocks that are brought to the surface and by volcanoes called mantle zenoliths or mantle nodules, and also there are parts many of your listeners might be familiar with serpentinized rocks, these sort of green slimy rocks that you see in mountain belts, and also they also crop out on the ocean floor where either through tectonics or through a mixture of tectonics and hydrothermal alteration, so reactions with seawater, mm-hmm. we've brought mantle rocks into the crust. So, you know, we know the basic structure of the crust. What we don't know is the really precise details.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Andrea in Oberlin Park, Kansas. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Hello.
I was wondering if you could speak to any advancements or innovations that you've made with actually coring this hard crystalline rock at these depths, and especially at 30-foot lengths in the wireline system. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Yes, okay. So, you know, there's two projects that we've discussed in our article. One is, expedition of the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program that's going back to this relatively deep hole in the eastern equatorial Pacific next month. The other is this desire to drill all the way to the mantle. So that second project is going to be far more technologically demanding than our current abilities, though our sort of understanding from discussions with engineers is that this is just no longer, you know, sort of fantasy, and it could be done given sort of investment and sort of political and scientific will to do it. Mm. So there's things that would need to be done. We would need to have some form of riser-like system, same as the sort of the oil petroleum companies use, that would work in very, very deep water, and we're talking about 4,000 meters or so. We would also need to have drilling equipment muds and lubricants, as well as wireline geophysical tools, that will operate at very, very high temperatures, you know, sort of 300 degrees or centigrade or more, and at these very high pressures, which are probably about 2,000 atmospheres at least. So, you know, the geophysical, the geothermal industry already has equipment and has, you know, have actually somewhat accidentally drilled all the way into magma chambers in Iceland. So this technology can work on land. It would need some significant adaptation to work in the oceans, but it's, you know, maybe not completely beyond human endeavor to do this.
We're talking about drilling into the mantle this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Damon Teagle. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two. We have a question from Second Life saying, what materials are the drill bits made of? What do you drill with? What is
The current drill bits are sort of adapted industry bits, and they are generally made of hardened steel with sort of roller cones of tungsten carbide. Ideally, when drilling hard rock, you'd want to have some, and if you were doing this on land, you would have your drill bits impregnated with diamonds. The difficulty with using that in the oceans is that the ship that you're drilling from moves up and down with the waves, and that actually makes the, you know, the motion of the drill bit on where it's trying to cut sort of keeps on moving the bit off, up and down off the surface, and tends to make diamond coring very difficult. So we've had to use these sort of industry drill bits. But certainly there could be advancements there by sort of developing sort of substances harder than tungsten carbide.
One last question for you. How do you know when to stop drilling?
Probably when the money runs out. Yes, well, I mean, our aim is to drill, you know, a number of hundred meters into the mantle, and what we would probably try to do is you can kick off deep drill holes and do directional drilling and actually try and penetrate the lowermost crust and the Moho and into the mantle in a number of different places, but one sample would be a revolution.
It would be. So you don't have an aim of how far down you can go, what percentage you want to enter, and how deep.
Well, yes, it's funny you mention that, because, you know, people are already talking, well, if we do this, what's next? I think the core is some distance away, but
you'll need a different drill bit for that one, I think.
That's right. But also, you know, that your earlier caller made a very important point. It's unlikely that this Moho boundary is going to be the same everywhere on the planet. So if we can do one, why not two, you know?
Yeah, but as you say, just limited by the amount of money you can get.
Yeah, the desire, this would also probably require people spending, you know, 1 to 2 years of their life above one spot in the ocean. So
who is funding this?
Well, it will be, assuming this goes ahead and the planning all works out and the technology is developed, it would be under the umbrella of the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program, which is a consortium of 24 or so nations around the world, principally supported by the United States and the Japanese, but with contributions from Europe and as well as China and India and other places.
Well, good luck to you.
Okay, thanks very much.
Happy drilling.
Okay, goodbye.
Damon Teagle is a professor at the University of Southampton, based at the National Oceanographic Center. That's at Southampton in the UK. I'm Ira Flatow, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.